Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
Would step in the car with reverb and the big arena sound. I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Ultimate Taxi, the world's only recording studio, theater, nightclub, planetarium, toy store, taxi cab. And I might have a sound effect of thousands of people cheering and stuff. And I'd say, thank you, hold your applause, please.
Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How an Aspen, Colorado Taxi Driver Transformed an Ordinary Taxi into the Ultimate Magical Mystery Money-Making Tour. The Ultimate Taxi was born on Halloween night, 1983. John Barnes' vision started modestly with a few flashlights, some dry ice, Star Trek light on the dash, and a good sound system, and some strategically placed Reynolds tinfoil. The rest is history. Today, John Barnes bills his taxi as the only music studio, nightclub, planetarium, toy store, and internet taxi on the planet. It's a rock and roll concert, roller coaster ride, magic show, movie ride, laser light show, and photo shoot. From the front seat of his 1978 Checker cab, Barnes orchestrated a sophisticated in-taxi light show complete with 9 lasers, 14 miniature stage lights, a revolving disco ball, and a $2,000 haze machine. The ride also includes toys, rainbow glasses, and a photo page on his world-famous website, www.ultimatetaxi.com. Famous celebrities like Ringo Starr, George Lucas, Jimmy Buffett, Clint Eastwood, Bob Dole, Michael Eisner, Michael Douglas, and Kevin Costner are among just of the few who have enjoyed his magical mystery tour. In this interview, you're going to learn and travel along with John as he describes his journey from novice taxi driver in Aspen, providing an entertaining ride, to purveyor of an otherworldly high-tech experience of a lifetime. You'll also hear how John successfully leverages free media attention and his cutting-edge technology to brand an unforgettable experience in the minds of his customers. You'll also learn how this not-so-ordinary taxi driver markets his business using these universal business-building lessons, lessons that anyone can take to their own business. For instance, develop a relationship to build repeat business. John made friends with other cabbies and dispatchers and cops by helping them meet their needs. He treated customers like friends, giving away free rides, leaving the meter off, and knowing where they lived and where they wanted to go. He remembered names. He also focused on the unique instead of just a ride. John sells fun and entertainment, always trying to boost his smileage, that's smiles per gallon, his guarantee either you have fun or there's no charge. Leverage your core business into multiple revenue streams. The Ultimate Cab is central to the trunk boutique memorabilia, the website, and media fees, and much, much more. You can come with us and take a virtual ride and discover the secrets of his magic touch. And don't forget to visit his website, ultimatetaxi.com. The next time you're in Aspen, tell him Michael Senoff sent you. Now let's get going. How on earth did you come up with this concept? When was the germination of this idea? How did it all start?
You know, in the mid-80s, I began driving a taxi cab in Aspen, which is a small community of 5,000 or 6,000 people.
Had you lived there for a long time or near the area?
I had lived there from about 1980 to about 1984, and I'd done a variety of jobs. I worked as a night auditor at a hotel, and I was a breakfast and lunch cook, and I worked for the ski patrol, and I worked for a guy that sold vending machines, and I just did a variety of jobs in the service industry And one day I was cooking breakfast and lunch, and one of the dispatchers from the cab company came in and said, "Hey, John, Fred would like to sell his cab and get out of town, and it's a great job. Why don't you take it?" And I said to myself, well, getting kind of tired of getting up at 5 in the morning to cook breakfast. It's getting cold out as we're getting into September. And so I bought Fred's cab, which was an old yellow New York Checker taxi cab with a great sound system in it.
And how much did you pay for it?
I paid $5,500 for the taxi.
Okay, now did that come with the rights to be a cabbie in Aspen?
The way it worked in Aspen was that if you were approved by the owner of the cab company, you could join the cab company and pay a weekly fee that would cover the licensing, insurance, and the dispatching. And you were basically kind of a private contractor. You paid for your own gas and repairs and kept up your own car. So there wasn't really like a medallion system where you had to buy into a statewide program that allowed you to be a taxi driver.
How many yellow cabs were there in Aspen at that time?
Oh, maybe 50 or 60.
Well, once you bought it, what did you have to do? How did you get prepared with becoming a cabbie?
You know, when I first started driving a cab, I think the first night I drove was Halloween night, which is a real crazy night. Everybody dresses up. Everybody that goes to work dresses up. It's just insane. And I kind of decked the taxi up a little bit. And, you know, I immediately realized that it was more than a job. It was almost like driving in a movie.
So because it was Halloween, you wanted to kind of do something to the cab. Spruce it up a little bit. It's Halloween. Let's have a little fun on my first night, right?
Exactly.
How did you deck it up that very first night?
You know, I think I put some flashlights on the floor of the car underneath my seat. And I put some orange gel coloring on the front of the light so that there was orange light on the floor of the cab. And I bought some dry ice, and I kind of poured fog onto the floor. So when you stepped in the cab, you stepped into a cab with orange fog on the floor for Halloween. And I think I put some aluminum foil over the top and kind of made it look like a spaceship.
But your intentions really were only just for Halloween, right?
I was just trying to basically make the night fun for myself as well as my customers. And from that night on, the people that would get in my car, you know, they never forgot how I had made the cab so much fun on Halloween.
Why? Because you'd have repeat customers and they'd talk about that?
Exactly. There were two schools of thought on how to drive a cab. One was to work the airport and the tourists and get in line at the airport and wait for the next plane to come in, which was about every hour, and hopefully you'd load off the plane and get a decent fare up to Snowmass, which was about 10 miles away, or Aspen, which was about 5 miles away. And the other school of thought was you stayed in town and took the bartenders to work and the waitresses home, and the airport didn't really run after sunset back then. So the evening shift was more driving the locals to and from work and taking people home from the bars and things like that. You got better tips, but it was a little bit more unsteady. So I definitely thought that, well, gee, you know, if you can make yourself stand out in a small town so everybody remembers you, not everybody may like you, but everyone remembers you, it seems like it can only be good for business, because if someone's at a party and someone else says, oh, can you call me a cab, someone's going to perk up, oh, let me call John, his cab's so much more fun than everybody else's. So I figured that if I made my job really fun and blurred the distinction between work and play, made it fun for me too, that it could only be good for business in a small town.
Please. So you're thinking, how can I make more money with my new business?
Well, yes, I wanted to make more money. It was an unusual job where, you know, if you drove by the movie theater and you saw a movie that you wanted to watch, you could say, I'm going to take a break for a couple of hours and park the car and go in and go to the movies. And then when the movie was over, you could come on back out and call the dispatcher and say, I'm back in the hack, and they give you a fare.
So you have your dispatcher, you have a radio, and when you're available, you let the dispatcher know, and if they have a call that comes in and they need someone who needs a ride, they call you.
Exactly. But if someone calls the dispatcher and says, I want this particular cab, they send you. So if you have lots of special requests, you're busy all the time as other people that aren't quite as outgoing and friendly and might sit around and have to wait for the anonymous call.
But if it's just a generic call, they'll put you in a queue and go from one to the other.
Right. So even as I was doing my specials, I'd be moving up on the generic queue. And when I was finally done with my friends, I'd get a call for another ride. So it was good for business. And I was the kind of person where if I dropped somebody off at the edge of town and I was driving back into town empty and I saw someone standing there waiting for the bus, I'd pull over and give them a free ride into town, introduce myself, give them my card, let them know that, you know, I'd love their business. After all, I'm driving empty into town. I might as well promote myself.
Right after Halloween, did you leave the lights in the car? Or did you take it out? And did the cab ever look like a normal yellow cab?
Well, I did take out the aluminum foil and the fog effects, but I did start to look for little gadgets that maybe had little flashing colored lights. I had a couple little toys that I glued onto the dashboard that kind of looked Star Trek-y in there, you know, chasing red, red, green, blue lighting and just little tiny stuff just to kind of be funny and some little minor sound effects.
So for how long was it just a little bit of it?
You know, when I bought this car from Fred, it had an unbelievable sound system in it at the time. And so I could really rock people out on their ride, and working the night shift, people were either going to or from work or to or from a party, and having the ability to make the cab a really memorable part of their evening. And then one day I went into the music store, and there was a little $150 keyboard. I didn't know how to play the keyboard. I was a classical oboe player in high school and grammar school, but there was this little toy keyboard that Casio made that I asked the owner of the music store if I could bring it out into my car and mess around with it a little bit. So when I brought it out to the car and ran on a couple of batteries, I found that if I plugged a audio cord from the output of the keyboard into the back of my equalizer that ran my sound system, I was able to basically layer the keyboard into the sound system. So at that time it was a cassette player, but I could play along with the cassette player. I could put on the Beatles and keep playing the song over and over again until I kind of figured it out. And I didn't do this because I wanted to necessarily amaze people in my car. I just wanted to have some interesting things to do in the car when I was sitting at midnight waiting for the next phone call to ring, to entertain myself, to try to make the job not boring. Some guys like to read magazines, some guys pitch quarters, and I wanted to mess around with these little portable electronics. And at the time, just like the laptop computers became faster and better and cooler every 6 months in the mid-90s, in the mid-80s, that same improvement in computer processing allowed the audio keyboards to go from the first one sounded pretty much like a toy, and the second one sounded like a grand piano. And 6 months later, they came out one that had all the instruments of the orchestra. The next one was touch-sensitive with pedals just like a grand piano. So it kind of became fun for me to try to keep the car on the leading edge of technology. My wife bought me a keyboard for Christmas, and I ended up gluing the two together, the little tiny Casio with this bigger keyboard, and it messed up the sound system completely. I couldn't really figure it out because I really wasn't an expert in audio and mixing sound. So I went back to the music store, and I said, this one keyboard sounds great when I play it by itself and the other one, but when I tried to wire them in together, everything sounded really muddy and soft. And he said, you've messed up the impedance of the system. You need a mixing board. And I said, what's a mixing board? They said, well, a mixing board has multiple inputs and the stereo out that you can go to your sound system and everything will sound clean. So I bought a mixing board at Radio Shack with a little 9-volt battery, worked perfectly, and that solved my audio problems. Once again, now I had the pipe organ and the sampler where I could say, we're having some fun now, and then play it in every different octave. We're having some fun. Because I'm kind of a entertaining guy, I just kind of messed around and tried to make people laugh because I figured that it was more fun making people laugh and take them to their location than just sitting quietly and not talking to them or interacting. So I had the two keyboards and went back to the music store. I said, well, I got these two empty holes in the mixing board. What else could I put in here? And they said, why don't you put a microphone in? So I bought a microphone, and it sounded like AM talk radio. It was very dry. I went back to the music store and I said, how do I make it sound like a big concert hall? And they said, well, you need reverb and delay. I said, you know, what's that? And they said, well, these are multi-effect processors that mess around with the sound that gives it that big stadium kind of arena echo. So I bought a little pedal that I guess is normally used for a guitar to make the guitar sound richer, but I fed my microphone through that pedal, which is also another 9-volt battery. Now I was starting to have lots of little 9-volt batteries and AA batteries running the show, but it wasn't really like I was saying, well, I'm doing this because I want to make more money. I was doing this because I wanted to make the job more fun than not being at work.
All right, so when were you adding all this equipment?
In the mid-80s, 84, 85, 86.
You were doing it slowly.
Right, I hadn't gotten into the stage lighting aspect yet. It was pretty much just a stack of keyboards, and I'd go to New York to visit my parents, and I'd go to the big music store, and I'd look around and say, well, what do you have that's small, that's interesting, and that runs on 12-volt power? And a lot of these things that have little wall plugs do run on 12 volts. I was trying to make the job fun for me. My attitude is life is too short to not have fun with the job that you do. You're going to sit in the cab for 12 hours a day. You got to make it so you enjoy it. Otherwise, it's going to rub off on your patrons that you're not really enjoying where you are.
Right. So what kind of feedback were you getting in the earlier days? Were you getting positive feedback? Did you get some negative feedback?
I was the busiest and most popular taxi driver in town. And I think the only person that didn't like the fact that I was entertaining while driving was an old lady who was the teacher of the elementary school, and she was about 85. And she said, you know, when I want entertainment, I'll go in to see entertainment. I don't want it with my taxi ride. But she was the only one that really gave me a thumbs down. So I felt like, well, if 99.9% of people, you know, I put a big smile on their face, I must be headed in the right direction, if you pardon the driving pun.
That time, when you bought the cab, how did it work? Did you have to charge a certain rate like all other 50 cabs? Was that regulated?
There were meters in the taxis, but the cab company didn't get a percentage of the meter. The cab company charged a weekly fee based on how busy they felt that week was. Obviously, Christmas week might be $100 a day, and in the slow seasons, it might be $30 a day.
I see. So it could vary.
Right, so because of that, the meter was really a tool that I was able to use to let everyone that rode in my cab know that they were going to get a little better deal than anybody else. If you got in the cab and the person didn't know you, they'd start the meter the second you sat down, and they'd turn it off when they got to your destination. For me, you know, I wouldn't hit the meter on until if I'd gone three or four blocks. And maybe if they stopped and said, can you stop at the grocery store? I need to pick up a quart of milk. You know, I said, well, the meter's off, take your time. You know, I was very lenient. I wanted people to feel like, well, they knew how much it cost to go from town to their house, but if every other cab driver charged them $7.50 and they gave them a 10, and I charged them $5 and they still gave me a 10.
All right, so you knew what you were doing, though. You were giving them something for free. You were kind of grooming them for more business down the road. Would you agree?
I was trying to make them feel that when they called and asked for me, they were getting someone that knew where they lived, that took care of them.
You're building your business. You want to give them reasons to call you. And if the reason why is John doesn't start my meter for three or four blocks and he saves money, I'm going to call him next time.
And because most of the people were in the service industry, they tipped well, and it made them feel better to leave a bigger tip. They knew they were going to probably pay me about the same as the next guy, but when they rode with me, they felt a little better getting out of the car because they felt like they were really taking care of me. Because the difference between the meter and what they paid was bigger, so they left a bigger tip. And it didn't matter to me. All the money I made for the night was all one big lump, and, you know, I'd have to pay my gas and my shift fee out of that regardless. So I wasn't cheating the company or anything.
Did you ever have, like, self-doubt? Did you ever say to yourself, you know, this is a stupid idea, or anything negative that almost quashed your idea?
Gee, that's a good question. Because I was just trying to make myself happy, I was trying to go to work and look forward to going to work and seeing who I was going to meet and having fun with knowing people's names, remembering their names was also very important. There might have been a little bit of animosity from the other cab drivers that didn't quite have the outgoing personality that I had, as far as John is a wacko.
Yeah.
But I don't think that caused me any self-doubt. Then, as I became more experienced in the taxi company, what happens is the taxi company would turn the telephones into the taxi system at night, and whoever was the late-night shift boss would answer the actual telephone calls right in the taxi on their radio. Your radio would go ring, 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 and you'd pick up the phone and say, hi, Mountain Taxi, this is John, can I help you? And someone would say, John, I need a cab in front of the Wheeler Opera House. And I'd say, Kenny, how close are you? And Kenny would chime in and say, I'll be there in 2 minutes. And I'd say, you'll see Kenny in 2 minutes, thanks a lot. So I ran a pretty good shift, too, because I was good at being clear with the customers as to exactly how far away the cab was, because they talked to the driver that was number one on the list. The other beauty of being the late-night shift boss was the fact that after 1 in the morning, if you were the shift boss, if you were available, you got the run. And everybody else, because they had pretty much finished their shift, they could hang out in case it was busy at night to see if they could stay busy. But if you weren't busy, you got the next run. So therefore, I was able to pretty much interact with everybody that worked at night because I'm the one that answered the phone when all the bartenders called. And then late at night at 2, 3 in the morning, I was the guy that picked up those bartenders and took them home. So I got a personal rapport in a small town. I know in New York City, you're not going to know everybody that calls the cab company. But in a town where there's only 10 or 12 night spots, and you end up driving home the 5 or 6 bartenders that take cabs home at night because, you know, after their shift is over and they're cleaning up the bar, they open up a beer for themselves and they don't want to drive, you know, after drinking, because that's when they relax and have their friends in the bar after closing and clean up.
And when someone's at the bar and they're bartending and they need a cab, they're going to call you.
Exactly, because I'm the guy that took them home. Sometimes, you know, I'd say, this ride's on me. It couldn't hurt to be remembered and friendly in a small town. I think that's a no-brainer.
All right, when did you start taking the taxi to another level with all the stuff on the roof and the disco lights and the disco ball? How much longer did that take before you got that going? And then why did you start taking it to a new level?
One evening, a friend of mine got in the car, who was kind of more of a electronics expert than I was. I had a very musical ride, and I had some little silly lights. I think I had a little ping pong ball sized mirror ball with an itty bitty book light on it. He got in and he said, John, he says, you know, the sound system is great and the whole audio thing that you're doing and the sound effects. He says, but you need better lighting. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you need chase lights, you know, lights that follow each other around in a tube, and you need par cans, you know, the stage lights. They make actual mini ones, the ones that you see hanging up above the stage at concerts. Well, they make little tiny ones that run on the same kind of low voltage lights that you might see in your bathroom or your kitchen or in a restaurant. So he showed me this catalog, and I said, well, look, you know, I've got a few $100 I'd like to put towards this project. Why don't you tell me what I should buy out of this book, and let's turn the cab into a more amazing experience in the taxi business in a ski town that's also very popular with summer music festival. There are kind of down seasons. October, November is slow, as well as May and June after the lift closed. So one of those off seasons, we took a couple of weeks and we rewired the cab with better lights on the floor that flashed and lights that ran around. And I think at the same time I went home to visit my family in New York City, and I went into this funny shop in Greenwich Village, and they had these look like Star Trek glasses, wraparound plastic glasses. And when you look through them, they made all the white lights rainbow. They were basically spectrum analyzers. They were prismatic.
I went to that website. Those are cool.
Instead of buying just one pair, I bought 15 pairs, figuring that, you know, when people get in my car and they want the ultimate experience, I'll hand out the trippy glasses and they'll have the virtual psychedelic rock concert ride. So with the enhanced lighting, and we also built a fog machine out of a thermos that one would use for camping, and a little plastic T-valve that you could buy at a plumbing supply store, and some heater duct hosing that I could run underneath the seat, I was able to build without any electrical parts, simply a thermos of hot water I could dump dry ice into and then cap the top, and the force of the fog pouring off the dry ice would just push it through the tube under my seat and dump it on the floor. So now I had an efficient fog machine with colored lights, blue and yellow and red lights flashing on the floor, and a couple of stage lights on my keyboards, and a bigger mirror ball that now had a motor on it. And I think the ultimate taxi was born, and that was around 1989.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. So when did you get your first media attention, and how did that come about?
I was just going to say that around 1989, I went to the cab company, and I said, listen, I don't want to be charged the same as everybody else. Everybody else needs to go to the airport and the dispatcher. And at that time also, there were now cell phones. Back in the early 80s, there weren't cell phones in the Valley. So I said, look, I've got my own phone number. I'm getting my own phone calls that are keeping me busy. I don't want to pay $500 a week for dispatching and the ability to work the airport when I don't want to work the airport or dispatching. I kind of want to be my own businessman. Cut me a new deal.
What'd they say?
As much as he liked me personally, he said, you know, John, we really don't want to start playing favorites and then everybody's going to want a special deal. So if you really want to do it yourself, my advice is quit the taxi company and go off on your own and get your own limo license or whatever.
You could do that if you chose to?
I told him that if I didn't work for the cab company, I would simply do the exact same thing I was doing, but I would be selling fun as opposed to transportation. From a semantics point of view, you could pay for the show in the car, and if I had no meter in the car, I could say, well, the ride is free, but the show costs $20. At that time, the taxi was white with blue decals on it. So we parted ways, and as soon as we parted ways, I had the car painted yellow and bought the checkers, so it looked like a classic old taxi cab from New York, figuring that if people saw me driving around, they'd flag me down thinking I was a cab, and I could say, listen, I'm not a standard cab. If you really need a cab to the airport or up to Snowmass, I'll call the cab company on my phone and get you a regular cab, and if you want to have a great time with your friends after dinner, this is the ticket.
But you didn't have any problems with the police that you were impersonating a cab driver or anything like that? That was a little bit of a concern?
It's funny, I always say that in order to do a job like mine, you have to be on a first-name basis with all the police in town and have a insurance company that's never actually taken a ride with you. But because of the fact that, you know, as I said, I like to give free rides when I wasn't busy because it was good. In the off-seasons, when I'd see the police taking a walk around town, I'd say, hey, you know, Jim and Carrie, come on in and see what I got new in the car this week. So I was friendly with all the taxis, and I was the guy at night who the police would call when they had some belligerent guy on the street that they were just about ready to arrest for disorderly conduct, and a cab would come by, and we'd say, hey, we know where he lives. Let me take him home, get him off the street, And that would solve a huge problem for them. That was the guy that helped them when they didn't want to arrest someone, but they wanted to get them home safely at night.
Okay, so you went on your own, you converted it to look like an older yellow cab from
right.
New York.
And I considered myself almost a dispatcher for the taxi company that was parked in the middle of town because I didn't want the standard taxi rides. I didn't want to steal money from the guys who were trying to make a living doing rides from A to B. I kind of had skewed off into more of a 20-minute amusement park ride competing with the horse carriage ride that takes people on a little ride around the center of town. And I also realized that Aspen was a really fun place for adults, but there was really not very much family entertainment. So there was no malls and there was no arcades. So if you took your kids out to dinner in the evening, there was really nothing to do with them after dark. So I figured, you're going to be the e-ticket ride at Disneyland. And therefore, you're not competing with the cabs because even though your show is in a cab, you're selling fun and memories and Polaroid pictures of everybody in the car. So I started taking Polaroids of every group ride, and they would get their Polaroids. And if I had some famous people in the car, maybe I'd take an extra Polaroid or two for my files.
How many years from the time you got the cab to where you made this transition to selling fun?
I think I worked for the taxi company for about 4.5 years before I quit the cab company and kind of skewed off into a musical theater nightclub. Club amusement park ride.
For those 4 years, you were always charging standard per mile rate.
Correct. Or I just wasn't running the meter at all because I had regular customers in the car and they always took care of me.
But you weren't selling anything else. You were earning income on your tips and your meter rate.
Right. And then when I skewed off, I decided I would charge $20 for 20 minutes. How much does it cost to ride in the car? It was $20. I'll take you and your friends on a little ride around town. And I think at that time, I also printed up some Ultimate Taxi t-shirts to sell out of the trunk. The trunk became a little boutique where you could buy the rainbow glasses to take with you. And I also, at that time, began buying the chemical light sticks that you see people wear at concerts around their neck.
And what kind of money did you make driving a cab in Aspen?
Back then, business was really good, and you could gross $250, $350, $400 a night. So if you worked 6 days a week and you brought home $400 a night, that's $2,400 minus your gas, expenses, tires. It wasn't a bad job.
Wow. And you had to pay the dispatcher.
You had to pay the taxi company. That might be $500 a week, and gas might be $500 a week. So if you worked 6 days a week and you persevered, it was pretty good money. Now, you know, if you only worked 4.5 days a week, it wasn't such a good job anymore because it took you 2 days to pay for all your expenses.
So you went over to the entertainment side of things, and you started out at $20, 20 minutes, right?
Right.
And what are you charging today?
Today, I do a ride that's about 45 minutes, and I charge $150 for the group, which, if you figure that I can put 5 or 6 people in the car, it's closer to $20 a person.
Yeah, that's pretty good value.
But, of course, you know, the fancy hotels have gone from $199 a night to $999 a night for the St. Regis and the Ritz-Carlton clubs and things like that. My clientele kind of skewed off from driving around a bunch of people out partying and bartenders to families and groups of people out. I kind of lost some of my local business because they really wanted to get somewhere, and I was more of a horse carriage ride around the mall.
Right, I got you. How'd you set up your business structure? I mean, were you operating as a sole proprietor, or did you incorporate the business, any kind of formality when you went to the entertainment type side of things?
I didn't try to patent or copyright what I did because I figured that, look, if people see what I do and it gives them the idea to try something like that where they live, good luck to them. I don't have a lock and key on making your job fun, and surely people will maybe come up with things that interest them to structure their business around, but I wasn't thinking in terms of, oh, this is something that I'm going to franchise and take worldwide. My thoughts at the time were, well, this is maybe a template for a real amusement park ride at Disneyland where maybe the cars could be on a conveyor belt and there could be an animatron at the top and they could be pulled through different visual experiences that looked like making the jump to light speed from Star Wars. I wanted to make the ride interesting as well as colorful, and I used to have a little telescope that was under my seat, and on some of the rides where we'd get out of the city lights, I'd pull over and show people the moons of Jupiter. Because up in 8,000 feet, the air is very clear at night, and you can see a zillion stars. And, you know, I have a little star chart that I could put out on my car at night, and we could figure out what we were looking at. And I could explain to people that the moons of Jupiter, that each night, you know, there'd be 3 on one side of Jupiter and 1 on the other. And 2 nights later, they'd all be on the other side of Jupiter, which pretty much proved that we weren't at the center of the universe because something was going around Jupiter.
That's a great idea. Let me ask you this. Did anyone ever knock you off in Aspen?
nobody really did.
You never saw any other taxi that was similar to yours that kind of took your idea? Anything like that? Or anyone around the country that you know of who've taken the idea to a new level or maybe not as good as you but tried to do it in their own area?
Well, for starters, I did notice that there were some luxury stretch limos. There was someone that took a Jeep Wagoneer and stretched it and put cool lights in it and stuff like that. And there was also Suburbans that had been stretched. So all of a sudden, I did start to see some luxury limos that were not only really interesting and unusual cars, but also a little TV with a fireplace on it and a bar. And they tried to make their ride kind of special. But there's something kind of intimidating about if you see a stretch limousine sitting on the street, you figure that either there's somebody in it because the windows are dark or somebody's hired it. You don't just think of it as being available. With a taxi light on it that's lit up, is a much more approachable vehicle.
That's right, because that's what you do. You approach a taxi and you get in.
People say, why don't you put this into a big limo or a bus? And I was saying, you know, I'm kind of happy with the way it is right now because everybody knows that old yellow taxi cab look. I mean, they're still using it in commercials today, even though the last Checker cab stopped rolling off the assembly lines in 1981.
Yeah, it tells you exactly what you got to do. You see taxi, I mean, to get in and go for a ride.
Exactly.
All right, tell me about how you got your very first media attention.
The local newspaper did a story about me March 23rd, 1989. I was the section header of the weekend newspaper.
Did they call you out of the blue, or did you have a contact? Did you know someone? Did you make any efforts to get in there?
Well, after 4 years of driving around in circles in a crazy car, pretty much everyone in town knew me, and I was approached by one of the writers that said, hey, John, I want to do a story about your car. And then later that summer, I think a freelance videographer who worked for WTBS, Turner Broadcasting, was approached by a show called Good News that featured interesting stories that were fun and made people smile. And he filmed me for the show on TBS, which actually, back then, the superstation was seen in like 60 countries. And one thing about getting on television and getting in the newspapers and magazines was that other people that were interested in doing interesting stories would kind of find. In other words, the press didn't really get me that much more business, but it got me a lot more publicity.
Yeah, let's talk about that. But I want to go back to the first story. Someone locally said, hey, John, I want to do a story on your car. You weren't in the publicity realm of things yet because it was just starting, right?
That's correct.
All right, so the newspaper did the story. Would he interview you in person or over the phone or what?
No, he spent an hour or so with me in the car and took a few pictures. And the story ran in the Aspen paper, which was distributed all up and down the valley.
And so when people read about it and they said, if you want to go for a ride, what did it say? Contact John Bards at the Ultimate Taxi? And what was the name of your company? If someone wanted to look you up in the phone book at that time.
It was called The Ultimate Taxi.
Okay, The Ultimate Taxi. Okay.
One of my quotes he put on the article in big print was it said, 10 times a night people tell me I should be on David Letterman. And another quote of mine was, it's got to be the only ride like it in the world. People get in the car and they're transformed. They get out with a big smile on their faces. They're happy.
You remember the day the story ran?
I do remember the day the story ran. It was March 23rd, 99. I remember I'd gone skiing the day before and I had sprained my thumb and it was really hurting. It was like, oh, I'm in such pain, but this story is so great.
Did you notice any kind of measurable increase in business or phone calls or anything from that?
Well, I definitely had people, whether I was in the grocery store or walking down the street or sitting in the middle of town in the car. But one of the ways I got business after I quit the taxi company and no longer had a dispatching service is I'd park at the busiest part of town and I'd put on a show just sitting on the street there and kind of prey on the intellectually curious. People would come over to see what was going on and I'd pitch myself. I'd say, listen, if you're not having fun in the car, I don't want your money. It's guaranteed. It's going to be the most unbelievable 30 minutes you've ever spent or else there's no charge for the ride. And obviously in the busy seasons when there were tourists in town, I would attract people that had never seen me before.
So you're generating business like that. So the first story got you a little more well-known around town, but it wasn't like the phone really started ringing off the hook with the local story.
It's true because it ran at the end of March, which is kind of the end of the ski season, and within a couple of weeks the lifts were closed and business was quiet and it wasn't like I could measurably see. I always expected not very much business in the slow seasons anyway because I was trying to create myself as a tourist attraction, and when the tourists weren't around I didn't expect to have much business. But certainly people would come up to you in the street and say, hey, that was a great story.
All right, how about the TBS? Tell me about that. Was that your first big story?
That was the first cameraman that filmed me and put me on national television.
Tell me about that whole experience, what you learned from it.
You know, it's hard to think back because since then, I lost track of about 280 camera crews that have filmed my story. I had days where I had CBS News at 7, German television at 8, and ESPN at 9:30 filming me. TV crews were fighting over their opportunity to do a story about me or add me to a story that they were doing about Aspen.
But one good story leads to another.
Right. I learned that media creates more media. And that why not try to take this newfound opportunity of free publicity? And, you know, I never paid for an ad, ever. I never bought an ad in the paper that said, call the Ultimate Taxi. And I realized that I had a tool that was like a media magnet. What I learned was that it could only be good, just like I didn't really measurably keep good enough records to say, oh, this month I made 12% more because I was on a television show. But I definitely felt like there was a positive aspect to it, and it was fun. I mean, the whole idea of the cab was so I could learn how to play keyboards in between taxi rides, and then it turned into me being a miniature Las Vegas show, and then learning about stage lighting and lighting design and sound mixing and electronics, and then when the computers came around, I started learning about computers and then the internet. So, I mean, what a learning experience. And having TV crews in the car, I started learning about how a television show was put together. How do they film a 4-minute segment for a TV show or a news story? And I do think that the story in the newspaper also got the Denver television stations interested in my story because they also read the wire services and get the papers from Aspen.
The first big story and then more media kept coming at you. Did you ever think to yourself, God, I've got all this free publicity. This is great for my business, but is there any other way I can monetize it?
Right. What else can I sell beside the actual ride where I have to be sitting in the cab?
Right.
Well, in 96, when I put the internet into the taxi and I had the world's first internet-connected taxi cab, my thoughts then were, well, you know, I've got this toy store, but people can only stick their head in the toy store and buy my retail when I'm actually parked in between rides. And if there was a way where people could reach in the trunk and buy things from my trunk when I was asleep, because they could buy it on my virtual website, which kind of showed off the fun and the character of the taxi, and also had a shopping area with a shopping cart where you could buy some glasses and some colored toys and some gifts for parties or bar mitzvahs or whatever. That was originally my thought when I put the internet in the car, was that it might be a way where I could expand the amount of hours a day that the cab was in business. And I did sell fun packs of toys from the virtual gift shop, and the publicity ended up giving me traffic to my website because I wanted to make sure on every television show I did, I had a website connected to the taxi. I certainly made sure that I talked about the fact that besides having digital cameras and lasers and fog machines, now we have the internet and you can check out the Ultimate Taxi online. So, you know, I found that I was getting, like you were saying, like 1,000 people a day to my website without spending any money on advertising. It didn't turn into very much retail sales. Trying to be the Walmart of the web, I had to compete with Walmart.
Yeah, some people really weren't buying stuff online.
Not enough to make it worth the time it took me as the guy that would fill the orders and run to the post office and ship them out and check the email and get the orders.
So you were thinking, how can I monetize it? I got this media attention that's very valuable. I can send them to my website, and that was initially the idea, to see if you could sell something to the visitors of the website.
I also found another way to get media beyond just people that had found out about me was the fact that when there was other interesting stories, you know, over Christmas, the news crews would come up to do a story about who the celebrities are that are in Aspen this week, whether it was Inside Edition or 2020, you know what I mean? So when I'd see a camera crew on the street or I see a satellite truck, you know, I'd pull up behind them and knock on the door and I'd say, hey, listen, you know, this guy and this guy and this guy all did stories about me. Why don't you just take a look and see what I got back there? And if you like it, I'll make some time available for you. And if not, no harm, no foul.
What would happen generally?
I'd always get filmed and I'd never make it on the cutting room floor.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
In other words, everybody would want to film me and everybody would use the footage that they got because it was a very colorful story that was kind of unique and fun, and there was enough bad news in the world. And it was the kind of story where they could come to town for one story and in an hour and a half they could get another story in the can. And when they went back to wherever they were from, it wasn't the type of story that was like breaking news that they had to use right away. They could wait for the weekend or a slow news day, and it was something to sign off for the weekend news I found myself being kind of a media slut.
What did you learn about the media? Because a lot of the visitors to my site, we have interviews with publicity experts. You know, from being on the other end and being the guy interviewed in your taxi, what have you learned about the media that maybe surprised you? How would you advise, say, someone interested in getting free publicity with a product or an idea or a concept? What advice could you give them when it comes to the media?
First of all, you have everything to gain and nothing to lose by pitching them your story. You may not get everybody interested, but it can't hurt to knock on a few doors or send a few queries out there and say, look, this is what I'm doing, and it's different. And next time you're in the area, put me on the list and make yourself available for free. It got to a point where I would say to the media, listen, the media is now my best customer. I'm doing 8 interviews a month, and I'm going broke because I'm devoting so much of my time to blocking off hours of my evenings for TV shoots that I'm not able to pay the bills anymore. And if you'd like to still have the Ultimate Taxi alive and well, I don't want to make rock star wages, but I would like to just make as much as I would make as if I were driving Mrs. Smith and her family around for a couple of hours.
All right, so as the demand got higher with the media, instead of giving it away for free and doing the story, you charged them like a regular rate.
Yeah, and I said, if you're going to hire a car to follow me around for tracking shots on the street, just think of me as renting another car. And basically, I'm not charging for my time. I'm just charging a location fee because if you want to have something that pops on the screen like a cartoon, I'm going to be spending all day waxing the car and cleaning it up and coming up with some new clever things that no one's seen before. And I've got consumables. I'm using glow sticks and dry ice. And it cost me some gas to put the show on the road.
Was it a problem? Any resistance?
No, it wasn't. Well, I found the hard news, they say, well, we don't do that.
Yeah.
If CNN wanted to shoot you for headline news,
you gotta do it.
Right, exactly. But if Regis and Kathy Lee wanted you to spend the evening driving Regis around as he did a segment about all the different nightlight spots in Aspen, you could say to those guys, everybody in the crew is getting paid except for me, the sound guy, the line guy, but I'm the guy that spent all this time, and I'm kind of a production assistant here. So I could get $300 or $400 or whatever, something to make the night worthwhile, because my wife, as much as she thought it was cool that I was on TV, she would want me to help pay the bills at the end of the month, and just having another videotape on the wall from another TV show just didn't cut it.
Yeah, I understand. Are you married with kids?
Yes.
How many kids you got?
I have 3. I have a 21-year-old, a senior in college in California, who, when she was 3 and 4 years old, she helped me glue the blacklight stars onto the roof of the car, and now I have a 9-year-old and 11-year-old as well.
So tell me about your show. When did you start incorporating the show and the music and developing your product?
Well, you know, I found the closest big city to Aspen beside Denver, which is about 200 miles, is Las Vegas, which is about 600 miles. And I was really pumped up on lights, lighting effects and colors. And Las Vegas, to me, was like a candy store. It was kind of like capitalism run wild with lighting designers. And, of course, if I went to Las Vegas and went to a show, I could write off the trip as market research for my cab. Knock on the door of the lighting guy's booth and ask him a few questions and give him my card and, you know, ask him about combinations. And I used to say that when everybody was watching the dancing girls on stage, I'd be looking over my shoulders at what colored lights were being bled onto the stage for the effects they were getting. It's like, oh, purple fog looks beautiful with green and yellow lights from over here. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. How many times did you do that?
It was kind of like an off-season trip to Las Vegas. I went on a regular basis. I wasn't a big gambler. You know, maybe $100 or $200 in the casinos. I wasn't trying to break the bank. I realized that those huge casinos weren't being built on the backs of the winners.
Right, but you went to really kind of research and look for ideas that would make the riding experience better for your customers.
Right, I'd go to Las Vegas and I'd see green laser light show and I'd say, oh my God, you know, that's incredible. I wonder if there's a miniature one that I could use in my car because I want to make sure that nobody comes close. I want to have a virtual Pink Floyd concert in my car when people all of a sudden look down and they're knee deep in purple fog and there's a laser light show going on over their head. And I also incorporated magic into the ride where I do a series of magic tricks.
Let's see this. Can you take me on a little virtual ride? A little step-by-step? Let's say I call you up and I say, John, yeah, I want to take an Ultimate Taxi ride myself and my family, and you come pick me up. What's the first thing that's going to happen?
People would step in the car with reverb and the big arena sound. I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Ultimate Taxi, the world's only recording studio, theater, nightclub, planetarium, toy store, taxi cab. And I might have a sound effect of thousands of people cheering and stuff. And I'd say, thank you, hold your applause, please. As the car would pull off from the curb and the music would start.
They're going for a ride. It's up to you where you're taking them, right?
Well, it's pretty much a ride where the destination doesn't matter. It's getting there.
What about the money? Is the money paid after or before?
At the end of the ride.
At the end, okay.
You'd sell stuff out of the trunk.
Keep going.
So people would get in the car, and I would bring up the levels of the music, so they would be surrounded by a great classic rock song. And then all of a sudden, they would see a laser beam dancing to the music on the roof of the car on a little screen that's on the center of the roof. And they'd all, you know, be pointing, oh, look at that, look at that. And then I'd reach over my shoulder while I was driving Floyd down the street, and I would do this magic illusion, which looks like I've taken the light off the ceiling, and I'm now holding a red light in my hand. And I'd throw it back on the ceiling and pull it off and stick it in my ear and pull it out my mouth and throw it back on the ceiling, and everyone would start laughing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, lights would come on the floor, and they'd realize that they were knee-deep in purple and red fog, and they'd all go, oh, my God, I can't even see my feet.
How do you activate the smoke machine?
Well, before they get in the car, I would break up some dry ice and have it in a plastic cup that was sitting on top of the thermos, ready to go. Once I started the fog, I really couldn't stop it, but I knew how much to put in so that it wouldn't fill up the car up neck high, because we still want to breathe oxygen in the car. There were enough cracks and leaks on the floorboards by the doors that it would all kind of leak out pretty quickly anyway.
So you had to get dry ice every night?
Every night before work, I'd have to stand in line at the grocery store and buy dry ice, because you can't save the stuff. It just evaporates.
Yeah, would it last you all night?
I would buy enough to do 3 or 4 or 5 shows. And if I had a really busy night, and I before work, I'd heat up water on the stove, and I'd bring hot water out to the car. Because the hotter the water, the less fog I needed to create the fog. So the first show would be hot water and a little bit of dry ice, and the next show would be a little bit more dry ice because the water had cooled off from the 100 below zero ice. If I had a really busy night, I could stop by the gas station, and they had a sink in the back, and they knew me at the gas station. I could run in with my thermos and dump out the cold water and put in some hot tap water. That would get the show back up to snuff. And then all of a sudden, white lights would start dancing around in circles in the car, and stage lights would start flashing on the equipment, and I had the company that made the haze machine. Besides the fog, which was a low cloud effect on the floor, I also found when I went to Las Vegas that the lighting looked really cool when you had some sort of mist in the air that allowed the lights to be like conic projections of color. So I had the company that made the big special effects for the Siegfried and Roy show at the Mirage design me. I paid a fortune for it back then. I think I paid $2,000. They were interested in seeing how small they could make one anyway. So they made me a mini haze machine that basically molecularized pharmaceutical-grade mineral oil. It didn't burn anything because I didn't want smoke in the air because those smoke machines smelled bad. And I wanted something where if there were no lights on, I could still see out the dashboard and drive.
So it molecularized baby oil?
Basically, and such a little amount that I only had to fill up the machine like every 4 months. But it put a little bit of like a haze in the air that you couldn't smell or taste, and it was harmless, but it made the light show look like a big arena rock concert, where like the front page of my website where you can see all the colors shooting out of the lights. It made the laser not just appear where it hit the wall, but you could see the laser shooting through the air. So I had like a 3D laser light show and fog effects, and this little magic trick that I would do where I basically had a little, and I don't mind telling you how I do this because it was one of the things that's the best seller in the Ultimate Taxi gift shop, because I do this trick that absolutely amazes people, and then later in the ride I teach them how to do it, and I pass the trick around to all the kids. I teach them a magic trick, and at the end of the ride I say, oh, you're there for sale in the Ultimate Taxi souvenir shop?
Tell me, what is it?
Basically, it's a little plastic cover on your thumb that has a pressure-sensitive switch and a little red LED light and a battery. Put it over your thumb. When you pinch it with your index finger, this red light appears in your hand, and when you open your fingers, the light goes out. You can reach by your ear and pinch, and it looks like you just pulled a red light out of your ear. I could reach up to the ceiling, and I designed some switches on the floor so that I could step on an old-fashioned high-low beam switch on the floor, and the power supply to my laser went through that switch so I could step on the button at the same time I pinched my hand, and it would look like I just grabbed this laser pattern from the ceiling that was the same color red, and I pinched my finger near it at the same time, and it looked like I just took the light off the ceiling and I was waving it around the car, and then if I pretended to throw it back on the ceiling and step on the button, it looked like I was playing catch with a laser beam. And I'd buy them by the dozens from the company that stocked the magic stores in Las Vegas. You know, I said, look, I'm not the biggest magic store. My store is only 4 feet by 2 feet.
All right, how about the drums, and what musical instrument are you playing in there?
Well, I have an electronic keyboard, and I have a digital drum set, and I also have an electronic wind instrument because I was an oboe player. Basically, the electronic wind instrument has a synthesizer that you can key up any instrument. You know, it can be the French horn or the tuba or the pipe organ or the saxophone with reverb and delay, and it also had the ability to transpose it to any key. So it was easy for me to learn a song on the woodwind because I could just figure out what key the piece was in and say if the key was in B flat, I could just say C equals B flat, and I could just play in C because, after all, I'm driving. I don't want to think too hard about the playing. So I'm driving around, and the music is playing, and all of a sudden I'm playing drums along with the music and kind of driving slowly down the street with my left arm on the wheel, watching what's going on in front of me, but I know where everything is in the car because it's kind of like I evolved with it. So I play a little drums, and I play little keyboards along, and I'm mixing myself in with a CD or a record that people have heard before. So I kind of size people up when they get in the car. If they're a little older, I might play a little jazzier set. And if they're younger, I might play more of a hard rock concert.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Are they talking to you during the ride?
I mean, it's like being at a rock concert. It's pretty loud in the car. I'm playing all these instruments and driving, and now I passed out the rainbow glasses, so all they see is colored lights everywhere. And as that song fades out, you know, I go into a little interlude where I play the saxophone with a severed limb. It looks like I'm playing the saxophone as I raise it up. It looks like there's a dismembered hand playing one of the hands of the wind instrument.
You get big laughs on that one?
Big laughs on that. The hand crawls along the top of the front seat. After that, you know, I say, now for something completely different. And at the same time, I've kind of worked myself to kind of a part in town where there's a dead-end street that's kind of long, where there's very little traffic, and I queue up on my laptop a virtual simulator of a roller coaster ride. So all of a sudden, they look at the screen at the front of the car, and it's dark out because I only do this at night, so you can't really see out the front window. They can just see the laptop screen, and it looks like you're sitting in the front seat of a roller coaster. You can just see the tracks, and all of a sudden, the thing goes... And at the same time, I give it a little gas, and we take off. And as the roller coaster ride starts to clack, 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 clack up the hill, I kind of slow down and speed up, and I keep goosing the gas so it feels like they're getting pushed back in their seat a little
bit. Yeah, oh, that's great.
As we're climbing to the top, and then when we get to the top, you know, I step on the gas and then the brake. And so as we're going up and over the top of the loops, they feel like they're actually on a roller coaster ride. So I do a roller coaster ride. Usually I do two, one down this dead-end street, and then at the end I say, did you like that? Everyone goes, yeah. I say, do you want to do a crazier one? They go, yeah. So I queue up one with more loop-the-loops and barrel rolls and stuff. As the track appears to barrel roll and you see the scenery go upside down and then back up again, if I just cut the wheel to the left and the right a little bit, they lean left and right. You know, it's kind of like a simulator.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So then after the ride's over, I say, ladies and gentlemen, as you can tell by now, safety continues to be the number one priority here in the Ultimate Taxi because, of course, the first person that I run into may very well be on the last ride I'm ever permitted to do around here. But keeping your safety in mind, it is suggested that you have those safety glasses on for the beginning of the next song, and, of course, this is strictly for your safety. So everyone puts their rainbow glasses on, and at this point, I take, depending on how many, if there's five people in the car, I take five of those 22-inch long glow sticks that haven't been snapped yet, and I dip them in the hot water of the fog machine so that they warm up, because the warmer they are, the brighter the colors.
All right, where do you have the warm water? In the front?
The warm water is basically to the left of my left leg between the door. I have to basically climb over the fog machine to get out and into the car because there's thermos, and they're kind of squishing me a little bit. It's like I'm squeezed into the front seat as a fighter pilot. I've got synthesizers and mixing boards and lighting computers and fog machines, and so I'm kind of squeezed in there. So then they all have their glass on, and I start the next song, and right as I start it, I bend the five light sticks and bang them on the wheel. I like the ones that have five different colors in each one, these multicolor ones. And I wiggle them and make this incredibly bright light show of all these colors in the center of the car. Since they can't see what's going on because they have the glasses on, which is just, so for every one light stick I'm in my hand, they see nine. So if I have five, it looks like they've got 45 light sticks in my hand. And I touch them with it in the back seat, and they kind of, you know, and then I throw the light sticks into the back seat, and they all take one and start doing their own light show. And then after that song is over, I say, well, you're all looking really colorful back there with all those light sticks. It's the photo session portion of the ride, and although I do a lot of things while driving, framing a good picture while driving is not one of them, so I'm going to pull over here, and I've got some lights I put in the car for lighting up television towers in the back seat, because if they put on their spotlight on the top of their camera, it wipes out all my colors. So I have these kind of gauzed white cans that I use to light up the back seat that gives good color balance so that you can see all the colors on the ceiling as well. And the ceiling has got black light effects and fiber optics and the electroluminescent wire that chases back and forth. So it's just crazy. The whole ceiling kind of comes alive. So I leave the lights on the ceiling on, and I take a series of photographs of them wiggling their light sticks with the glasses on, and then a couple of portrait shots. And as soon as I'm done taking the pictures, I pop the memory card out of the camera and slip it into the laptop and bring up those photos on the computer, and we take a look at the pictures I just took, which people love to see themselves.
That's free with the ride?
Right, and then I slide those pictures onto a CD. I have a blank CD queued up into the disk cartridge of the laptop, so I burn those pictures I just took of them onto a CD that comes as part of the ride, figuring that I only need to make one because either they can email it to their friends or pass it around and just copy them onto their different computers or whatever. And I say, well, I'm going to take the best couple of pictures that I take and I'm going to put them on my website because I offer immortality with every taxi ride. And I ask them what they'd like to call their group name on the web, because whatever they call it, the way I design the pages, you should be able to Google whatever you called your ride in a couple of days, and it should be on page one of Google. Bring those pictures onto the CD, I do a magic show where I do a card trick where I ask them to name any card in the deck and think of it, and then when they tell me what it is, I open up the deck, and the only card in the deck that has writing on it is the card. I said, before I left the house, I took a green Sharpie magic marker, and I wrote the word taxi on one card. And it's the card they think of. And I do a trick where I make a bottle vanish. It's in a white paper bag, and I backlight it with a blue stage light so you can kind of see it silhouetted in the bag, and then all of a sudden I collapse the bag and it's gone. And then I also explain to them how I did that magic trick with the laser on the ceiling, and I give everyone a chance to be a kid. The beauty of that magic trick is all you have to do is be able to pinch your finger and your thumb together. Even if you are a little uncoordinated in the first minute or two, by minute three or four, you're an expert at it. So everybody comes, I teach them the magic trick and mention that I've got a gift shop in the trunk, and I do four or five quick magic tricks.
All right, so by that time, are you almost back to where you picked them up?
Well, I'm kind of zigzagging around town. I mean, I'm just trying to stay off Main Street where there's traffic lights and real traffic. In the evenings in a small town, if you work the residential neighborhood, there's nobody. All I have to worry about is running into a parked car. And nobody really is looking out the windows anyway. I make a couple of sweeps past the restaurants while everybody's waving their light sticks because I figure, well, if the car is really colorful, I want someone that's looking out the window of their restaurant to say, what the hell is that? And the waiter will say, oh, that's the ultimate taxi. It's really fun. Everybody does it. And figuring that there's going to be occasionally people that say, well, let's do that after dinner. And then my phone rings when I drop those people off, and it's someone saying, hey, you know, if you're available, we'd like you in front of Mezzaluna. Or,
what's the maximum amount of shows you can do in the evening?
Well, that's the problem with the job, is it's kind of self-limiting, because what's fun to do for a couple hours becomes a real job, so you keep winding yourself up and resetting all your tricks and doing it over and over and over again. But right now, if I'm charging $150 for a ride and half the people give you $170 or $190, or they might buy a couple of toys for the kids and they might give you $220. So if you do three rides and you go home with $600 cash, you have no employees and you don't have to pay the taxi company, you just have to pay for your own insurance and you keep your cab up, you could see how it's not a bad one-man show type of job. The guys that are musicians in the club, they got to break down their equipment. And it's a real job, and they probably don't make the third of that.
So generally, all right, it's $150. What's the biggest tip you've ever gotten?
On New Year's Eve, Prince Bandar, the Prince of Saudi Arabia, I charged him $300 to spend an hour up at his house taking some of his house guests on a ride, and he gave me $1,000 in cash, $700 tip, and a bottle of Dom Perignon.
Wow. All right, what's his second best tip?
Oh, you know, you ask for $150 and people give you $300. Doesn't happen that often. And some people don't tip you at all, and it's best to just charge what makes you happy. If they tip you, you say you appreciate it because you got a lot of overhead, you know, between the cell phones and buying new technology and laptop computers and internet connections and new technology for the car, not to mention tires and all those normal type of expenses associated with driving a vehicle.
So the end of the ride comes.
Right, so then we do another song or two, and I say, you know, where would you like to end up? And I work my way over to that location. They might say, oh, you know, can you drop us off at our hotel, or we're going out to dinner, can you drop us off in front of the Hickory House or whatever, and that's no problem. As long as it's in the general area of town, and pretty much everything is, and if people really need to go 15 miles away, I say, listen, I've got another group in 12 minutes, and there's no way I can take you all the way there and back, but you can afford $150 to play around with your friends. You can afford $16 or $20 to have me call a cab.
So how do you close it up? How do you ask for the money?
Well, you know, at the end of the ride, you can go to the back of the car, and I pop the trunk, and it's kind of decked out with some interesting little $5 and $10 knick-knack kind of toys for kids. It's not a hard sell. I explain to people that, you know, it's a short season, you know, and I buy these things for $11, I sell them for $15. I'm not looking to, but you know, if I sell a bunch of stuff, it can help me pay the gas.
You should be marketing stuff out of there. Do you sell t-shirts still?
I don't sell t-shirts anymore, just the folding and putting them in plastic bags and keeping them clean. And when I started skewing off these last couple years into another business, I kind of let the retail slip a little bit.
So you process your credit card right while you're out?
I mentioned that besides it being the highest tech taxi in the world, it has the lowest tech Visa imprinter in the world. I have the old little, you know, where you pull your hand for it.
Yeah.
And I can run their card there, and when I get home, I punch it into the machine in my office.
You know, I just ask them if they have PayPal and go pull up your PayPal account.
Right, but then if I'm not online, then very rarely do I get a card that's not accepted. And if I do, you know, when I've taken the reservation, I've got their phone number. I call up. I say, listen, can you give me another credit card? That one didn't go through for me. I've thought about charging them when they make their reservation. And occasionally people, you know, the kid broke her arm and we're not going to be able to do it tonight. Those things happen. You know, I don't want to charge people that didn't have the funds.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. No, I understand. Tell me some of the most memorable celebrities you've had in your text.
Did you take a look at my famous faces on my website?
I have here George Lucas, Ringo Starr, Jimmy Buffett.
Actually, when Ringo rode in the car, I had pitched Alpine Sound System. I figured, well, look, I'm getting all this publicity, and I've got this high technology, the newest, coolest stuff. I found that if I called up Yamaha, I said, listen, the Discovery Channel is coming in to do a story about me, and I'd like to show them that great new keyboard that you guys are selling, but I've got the discontinued model from last year. Do you think you could upgrade me? So Yamaha started giving me free equipment, and I said, well, gee, if it works for Yamaha, maybe it'll work for the Sony camcorders and Hitachi computers. So I started getting a lot of free equipment from big corporations. My plan was, someone's going to see this and say, this makes a great commercial for Sony Camcorder. Capture the moments of your life in a colorful visual package, and maybe I could have a big payday with a Sony or a Yamaha or something like that as a product spokesman. Yamaha did hire me, and I trucked the taxi down to Nashville for a big trade show for the music industry.
How much did they pay you for that?
I think they paid me $10,000. They rent a truck and drive it from Colorado to Nashville, Tennessee, and have a partner to help me get the car on and off the truck. So I paid my friend $700 to come with me for the week. And it was an adventure. And we filmed the whole thing. And I figured we'd do the behind-the-scenes video of the adventures of the Ultimate Taxi. So one of my friends who was kind of a helper that when I did the TV show, I'd hire him to use my camera to film over the shoulder of the camera crew. So when VH1 was filming me for the world's smallest mobile recording studio, he was in the huddle with the producers and the cameramen discussing how they were going to shoot it and then staying out of frame, but kind of capturing the experience. And I've got hundreds of hours of videos that I put some clips up on my website, but I really could create a whole show.
The whole show of the experience that a rider gets.
Well, just the adventures of the Ultimate Taxi, whether it's today we're going on a trip to Las Vegas, and I wanted one of these big companies that have the Consumer Electronics Show to use me at the trade show, but I wasn't able to get a sponsor for that, so I just decided, hey, let's just go down to Las Vegas with the taxi ourselves, and we'll film the whole trip just to show them who they're dealing with. We'll make the evening news in Las Vegas during the trade show, so that when the people are in their hotel rooms after the show and they turn on the news, they're going to see the high-tech taxi cab. So I went down to Las Vegas, and we drove to the TV studio, and I said, listen, you know, I've come here because I've got more lights in my car than the Vegas Strip, and I've got more magic tricks than Siegfried and Roy, and it's not a busy night. Maybe you want to do a couple minutes on the cab. And so I ended up doing a couple of TV shows on the Vegas Strip with their reporter in the back seat, then ran up to our hotel room and then filmed the television set with a camcorder and filmed them filming us. And also, when we had local camera crews, or if I was driving in the parade, I'd film it because I figured that people could maybe, I wasn't thinking monetarily as much as the fact that it was history.
I'm going to go through some of the celebrities who you've had in your Ultimate Taxi.
Just to say about Ringo, he was eating dinner at a restaurant, and I was having dinner with the rep from Alpine, trying to see if they would buy the sound system, my car, and I saw Ringo eating at the table across the dining room. So when I saw that they were getting ready to leave, I went outside and got the cab, which was parked a couple of streets away, and parked in front of the restaurant with all the lights going. And when Ringo and the people he was having dinner with, some real estate agent, came out, the rest said, oh, there's still some taxi, we got to do that. And, you know, and next thing I know, I'm entertaining one of the Beatles, and you can't really top that.
Yeah, that's great. All right, how about Jimmy Buffett?
Back before I even had the whole experience when I was a taxi driver, he was one of my best customers. He had a house about 15 miles down the highway from Aspen, and when he'd go to a party late at night with his friends and call a cab, I'm the one that answered the phone, and they say, Jimmy needs a ride home, so I'll take that one, you know?
Okay, how about going to Eastwood?
I had driven around some movie director, I'm not sure who it was, and he was staying at the Warner Brothers house, and Clint was there, and at the end of the ride, he says, I got to get Clint in the car, so he went in the house and brought out Clint, and I did a little show for Clint, just a little five-minute tease. And Fortune magazine had some conference with Colin Powell and Bob Dole, and I saw Bob Dole walking down the street, and I jumped out of my car, and I said, you know, Senator Dole, I said, Senator Bradley rode last week and thought it was terrific. Oh, Bradley was in there. Let me in that thing. He had a great sense of humor. I was like, God, if he was this loose when he was running for president, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, I would have given him a second look. But he was a heck of a nice guy.
How about Michael Eisner?
And Michael Eisner actually was funny. I was at the gas station gassing up, and Michael pulled in, and I guess he had some rental Jeep, and he was kind of befuddled. He couldn't figure out how to find where you put the gas in the Jeep.
How'd you know it was him?
In a small town, you know. And actually, it was funny because Michael and I went to the same grammar school in New York City. He was several years ahead of me. I didn't know him when I was at the school, but I knew he went to the same little private school in New York City that I went to.
All right, so he was trying to figure out where the gas went. And
yeah, and I walked over to the Jeep, and I said, I think it's underneath the license plate on this one. And I pulled the license plate down, and there's where you gas up the Jeep. And while he was gassing up, I kind of forced him to come over and take a look at the cab. He jumped in the back, and he thought it was terrific. And then the next day, his wife called me and said, we've got some people coming in at the airport, and could you bring them down to our house for us? And you bet I can.
Okay, that's great. And Michael Douglas?
And Michael Douglas, he wrote a couple of times. Matter of fact, he's a very friendly guy. I remember the last time I saw him, I was double parked in front of a hotel, and he was just leaving the hotel, and he saw me parked behind him, and he jumped out of the car. He was with his wife, and he left his wife in the car, and he jumped out. He came over, he shook my hand. How you doing, John? You look great, and good to see you. So, you know, it's kind of a nice job where you get to not only meet some of the people that you respect in the entertainment business, but you get to make an impression of them that they can never forget.
Yeah, that's great. That's exciting. Let me ask you, what about when it's not nighttime? Are you driving at all during that, or are you just waiting for it to get dark?
I don't allow TV crews to film me until it gets dark out because the big spotlight in the sky kind of wipes out all my tricks.
Yeah, so you're not cabbing during the day?
Not at all, which means in the wintertime, it gets dark at 5:15 or 6 o'clock at night. Between 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock at night, you could stay pretty busy. In the summertime, it doesn't get dark till 9 o'clock or 8:30, and I book my rides an hour apart because I don't want to feel rushed or rush the people if they're a few minutes late. I don't want the job to stress me out, so I kind of space them out enough. So if I do a 9 o'clock and a 10 o'clock, that's it. So in summertime, I usually just do one or two rides. And in the wintertime, I could do three or four if I feel like it because there's just more nighttime. But if I do my first ride at 8 o'clock at night, at 6 o'clock at night, I'm charging up the batteries in the trunk, and I'm setting up the gift shop, and I'm in the car with a hot glue gun fixing anything that fell off the ceiling from the night before. So there's about an hour of prep for every hour I'm actually entertaining. Entertaining people, I could do it for free. It's fun. When you have a bunch of people in the car and they're having a great time, it's just driving it up to town from my house and cleaning the car and the windows and, you know, all that stuff to try to make it really sharp is the part that's the real job of it.
Do you have anyone who's thrown up in your cab?
Fortunately, I haven't. I think the worst I had was someone that threw up out the window, and I had to take the car directly to the car wash and hose it down before I went back to work.
Have you ever let someone else drive the cab?
I really haven't, because I'm concerned that if I let someone else drive the cab and work the cab, that if they got distracted by all the lights and equipment in the car and ran over somebody, that would be the end of my career. I know that would give me press, too, the kind of press I didn't want. Ultimate Taxi, Injures 3, News at 11.
Where do you keep your cab? Do you keep it in a garage?
I do. I live in a house that has a little two-car garage, and my wife's car is on one side of the garage, and I'm on the other. And when I'm not driving, I usually have, you know, those battery chargers that you see at the mechanics to keep the batteries topped off, because even though they are all connected to the generator, I drive around at 5-10 miles an hour when I'm entertaining, and it's not really fast enough to recharge all the batteries, and I want to make sure I have enough power that when I kick on all my lights, I don't pull my voltage so far down that the music stops.
Has that ever happened?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's a learning experience. I got to the point where I had too much lighting in the car for the battery, so I put another battery in the trunk. So I have three car batteries in the trunk and miles of wires and relays and fuses and all sorts of stuff.
How many miles are on the cab now?
You know, the speedometer stopped at 300,000 about 15 years ago. But in the last 15 years, since I've been driving around town for a couple of miles each night, instead of when I was a cab, I'd be shooting up and down the highway and putting a couple hundred miles a night on the car. So I don't drive it as much. I'm sure there's a half a million miles on the car.
Yeah, have you had to put a new engine on it?
once. The first engine lasted about 250,000 miles. You know, people say, how many miles a gallon you got? I go, it's not miles a gallon, it's smiles a gallon I'm looking for. So I figured that if I made my job really fun and blurred the distinction between work and play, made it fun for me too, that it could only be good for business in a small town.
I hope you've enjoyed this magical mystery ride with John Barnes and his famous Ultimate Taxi. If you have any questions whatsoever, please email me at michael@michaelsenoff.com or go to ultimatetaxi.com. Thanks for listening. For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com.